Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
Let's say an individual comes to you personally asking you to invest to start up a business. And you look at their spending and they're spending twice what they're taking in. There's no way I would give them funds to start a business, right? If they can't manage their own resources well, then how could you invest into them? But the government seems to get away with it and we're okay because asset prices are going up for now.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
The Fed cuts rates. It could have been one of the most colossal blunders. Is it? We don't know. We're going to talk about inflation, a little bit on gold, and we have to talk about these crazy markets a little bit more. Wow, lots to unpack today. Historic blunder or not, Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul. Good to see you.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you on a wild day.
Wild day. Well, I wanted to just, you know, Fed cuts rates. What does it mean to you, the audience out there? And again, this is Finance U, so we'll explain things as we go along. Nick Timmerhouse, who's the Wall Street Journal sort of like Fed scribe, has special access, which means he just writes down what they tell him to say earlier than other people. That's what it means to be a Fed reporter.
That's good.
Yeah, so a narrow majority of officials penciled in a total of at least three cuts this year. So it's not a full majority. Three cuts this year. They cut by 25 basis points. That's a quarter of a percent. Two more cuts, probably also a quarter of a point. So 75 basis points in cuts by the end of the year. It feels like the end of the year is almost here already, Paul, because it's September. So, a couple more cuts, and the statement changes, he interpreted them as dovish, and the only dissenter was Moran, wanted to cut 50 basis points. I'll take the other side of this. I think they should have hiked rates.
I'm with you. Inflation's too high. Housing prices are too high. Basically every asset class outside of energy and commodities is an all-time high in emerging markets. So it doesn't make sense. If you're concerned about inflation, your mandate is to keep inflation at 2%, then get it out of the way and raise rates.
Yeah. I mean, look at this. Geiger Capital put it really well, I thought. S&P 500, all-time high. NASDAQ, all-time high. Gold, all-time high. Bitcoin, all-time high. Home prices, all-time highs. Time for Fed to cut rates. You know, it's just, It's that silly. But, you know, the reason you cut rates, Paul, for everybody listening is because you want to stimulate more activity. The idea is if there's lower rates of interest out there, I guess you could afford more. People will do a little bit more borrowing. And we have, of course, a credit-based economy. Fine. But in truth, when they cut, it's supposed to create more liquidity out there, too, meaning it's just easier. There's a lot of money sloshing. Money's easier to come by. I just want to put in here, let me go full screen. This is US M2 in green, then China's M2, M2 being a broad measure of money within a system, Euro M2, Japan's M2. Look at what we're looking at here. Everybody is just exploding their money supply higher. Sure, yeah, cut rates, because you know what, Paul? I don't know. I think things weren't quite eased. The punch bowl wasn't quite spiked enough.
No. I mean, a report comes out today that retail traders are 66% of the market now. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've fueled this environment of speculation, raise rates to the point that asset prices come down and people deploy capital in productive enterprises instead of speculative enterprises.
Yeah, totally agree. Well, let's look at their statement real quick. I got Jerome Powell saying, I think basically these same words. We should just sort of look at some body language here, maybe. The red underlines with lines through it means that was in the last statement. And so this time, what did they change? So you can see here very clearly they changed the date from last time was July 30th. Now it's September 17th. So when you see that, everybody watching this, the red line just means that was the last time and this is what they replaced it with. So it did say last time, although swings in net exports continue to affect the data, they crossed all that out. And they just went with something very vague. Recent indicators suggests that growth of economic activity moderated in the first half of the year. It's been pretty anemic, true. Job gains have slowed, they added, and the unemployment rate has edged up but remains low, and inflation has moved up and remains somewhat elevated. So Paul, you know, they talk about the Fed having a dual mandate. They don't. They only have one mandate, honestly, which is to make the markets go up and to the right. But on paper and by word, they say, we're here to support full employment and stable prices. So I guess they're picking here and they're saying, I guess we have employment was a little weak. And we talked about that last time, right? What, 911,000 jobs revised away. Maybe they're a lot weaker than we thought. But they're basically saying, we're going to throw prices under the, we don't care. Inflation's high, but we're going to cut anyway. Is that, I mean,
I can't read it any other way. You know, I would phrase it as inflation's high and we're going to further screw the middle class and the poor in our society by causing prices to go higher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, I mean, with the data that we're looking at right now, and if the economy is as good as what they're telling us that we are, you know, this is early cycle easing activity in a late cycle environment. Now, be honest with us and tell us that you think that we're headed into an economic calamity and slowdown, and you're going to raise, you know, cut rates to try to get some momentum going before we go in there. But that's not the narrative they're telling us. They're telling us everything's great, inflation, you know, the economy is great, unemployment's a little soft, so we're going to cut rates. And if it continues like it has been over the past 10 years, that's going to help asset owners at the expense of affordability of housing and anything else for our younger generation. This is not solving the problem. It's helping the top 10% at the expense of everybody else at this point.
Yep, that's how I see it. So let's play a little game. Call this one Spot the Fib. This is Jerome Powell. Here's what he said today.
My colleagues and I remain squarely focused on achieving our dual mandate goals of maximum employment and stable prices for the benefit of the American people. While the unemployment rate remains low, it has edged up. Job gains have slowed and downside risks to employment have risen. At the same time, inflation has risen recently and remains somewhat elevated. In support of our goals and in light of the shift in the balance of risks, today the Federal Open Market Committee decided to lower our policy interest rate by a quarter percentage point. We also decided to continue to reduce our securities holdings.
I think there was a fib right up front, right here.
My colleagues and I remain squarely focused on achieving our dual mandate goals of maximum employment and stable prices for the...
And stable prices. Can we explore that real quick? We already know that labor was weak, right? We talked about this last time. You know, added 911,000 fewer. That's a funny way to say we counted 911,000 ghost jobs that weren't there. Absolutely blockbuster historic revision, one of the largest benchmark revisions ever. So, yeah, labor's weak, but look at this. Charlie Bilello reporting here on September 15th, the Fed is cutting rates into 4% average inflation since 2020. 2% target. That was half of his mandate. Oh, stable prices. And even 2% isn't stable. Obviously, 2% means your money is worth half as much in 35 years. So if you had $1 million in the bank, got a concussion, Rip Van Winkled it, woke up 35 years later, it would have the purchasing power of just $500,000 due to 2% inflation. You decide if that's stable or not. At any rate, they printed trillions into the COVID fiasco, bills still coming due. If they had any backbone, they'd be hiking rates this week. I totally agree. So the blue line down here, this would have been the trend if we just sort of kept it at like a 2% rate. But this red is what we've actually experienced. And it looks like this. I think this means the Fed's making a historic mistake here. I really do, because people are getting cranky about this kind of stuff. 2% inflation over 5 years, when you multiply that and add it up, it should be 10.4% total inflation. Dozen eggs is over the last 5 years is up 170%, which you will notice is more than 10.4%. Pound of coffee is up 97%, which is more than 10.4%. Auto insurance, 60%. Now, these are a lot of things you can't avoid, like, you know, auto insurance, fuel oil, gas utilities, home prices, transportation, gasoline. Paul, we're talking about stuff people just need to live in a house and go to work. Electricity, restaurants, okay, you could duck out on that if you had to. Shelter, though, can't. You can't escape going into used cars, groceries, more than double what they should have been. Family health insurance, nothing here is even close to 10% over the last 5 years. And they're trying to tell us that they care about inflation, stable prices, sorry.
They're so detached from the reality of what's taking place with the other 90% of the economy. that they can't imagine. It's just numbers on a report for them, and they're not feeling it in their own lives. And what I would say with Jerome Powell's net worth and most of those that are on the FOMC committee, they're in the top 1% for sure. They're completely detached from all of those pressures within their society. More than likely, they've got somebody else doing the shopping for them, and they're not even seeing the increase in those prices for them because their incomes, their balance sheets are high enough that their asset prices are more than covering up for the inflationary pressures that the average American is feeling.
So maybe when you just want to renovate a single building and the bill comes in at $2.5 billion, maybe you could notice, maybe they would notice then that inflation is more than they thought.
Have you seen any pictures of that thing at $2.5 billion? I mean, it should make the Taj Mahal look like a shack with that kind of budget.
No, I was down at that, before the election, there was a Rescue the Republic thing, brouhaha. Anyways, right down the Washington Mall, so we drove right up the street that the Federal Reserve is on, and they had those big tubes coming out the windows that go into, like, concrete, you know, dumpsters and... yeah. So, and then a year later, same tubes, you know, it's just like, they hadn't gotten far. The demo was taking more than a year. So,
well, sometimes I wonder if it costs them $1.2 billion and the rest of it's just handouts to their buddies that get the contracts for the work. I mean, I hate to be that cynical, but it sure seems to be the way the government seems to operate.
Right. Hey, eggs, gasoline, houses, all that. You and I have talked about this, Paul, but I mean, palpably, people are starting to get really angry. Stephen Moore reporting here that property taxes nationwide on average jumped 7% last year, which you will notice is not 2%. 7%, for those doing math at home, if your property taxes go up 7% a year, in just 10 years, they've doubled. Yeah. That's what 7% means, using the rule of 72 and some slightly sloppy math, but close enough. He writes, families and retirees are getting crushed. Arthur Laffer, the co-architect of the Reagan tax revolution, is now working in six states to cap property taxes like California's Prop 13 did in the 70s. So history might be repeating itself. I predict, Paul, there's going to be tax revolts too. I mean, listen, auto insurance, home insurance, health insurance, property taxes, these are all just the system predating on people. There's no explanation for this that makes sense, unless we're going to admit inflation was a lot higher than even 2 or 4% last year.
Yeah, and the sad part is, Chris, they're not going to interview these people on CNBC. But what happens if you retired, you had a corporate pension? Corporate pensions, unless you're working for the government, rarely have consumer price inflation linked ties. So it's a level income. So you retire at 65, you've got that pension that goes through, and then you got Social Security as your other income for the large majority of Americans. So that comprises the large majority of their income. CPI, we know, is at least 30% below the actual cost of living, if not half. And you've got all of these extra pressures that are coming along. And it's just brutal for somebody that's in their late 70s, early 80s. Maybe they didn't quite plan as good as they thought they should. Maybe they were too conservative back in after the 2008 crisis. So they had all CDs. Interest rates were artificially held zero. This has just been a very slow erosion of their purchasing power that's really weighing on families at this point. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not an honest system.
No, it totally isn't. And I predict this is going to be a historic mistake by the Fed because the signal is going to go out that, hey, inflation, we're just going to let that run, right? Under the theory that they can help, you know, employment. But I didn't, you know, if the Fed was actually realistically caring about that, and they don't. I think they just lip service. It's like them saying safe and effective. They're just words they use that justify what they're up to. They honestly care about keeping the system intact, and they like asset prices rising so that the 1% and above do very well. And that's who they are. And listen, it's a private banking cartel, so I get it. I just don't like that. The Timmerhouses and the other journalists don't actually ask them any questions, right? Hey, Jerome Powell, you're going to cut rates a quarter point. Tell us how you think that's going to offset AI job losses.
Great question.
Hey, every time you've cut rates, the wealth gap has gotten wider. Is this, are you unaware of this? Or tell us why this is your policy, why you think this is good for the country. You know, a lot of questions they could ask. But This is where I think it's going to boil over. Did you see this? This came out in Bloomberg yesterday, the day before.
No, and they're asking consumers.
Just they ask a question. It's a survey. And by the way, consumers, that is a really derogatory term. That you might as well say farm animals. just a point, right? But they're happy calling us consumers. I actually think I'm a human being, but that's separate. Consumers fear anticipate that inflation-adjusted income is going to fail to keep up with prices during the next 1 to 2 years. That's what they think. But this this is a fairly stable thing. It's sort of, it's noisy, but it kind of goes like this. This is one of the most extreme departures we've seen in the series. So, 7 out of 10 people are pretty sure that they're going to fall behind. And you know what?
Yeah,
I think they're right.
I think they're right, too. And what's interesting is that I think that's a good reflection of 70% of the populace at this point, since all that money was printed during COVID, that are realizing and becoming awake to what the government's doing. And it's not taking care of them. Mm-hmm. It's taking care of the top 2 to 5%. And the other 5 that's in the top 10 are benefiting because they've been able to have excess income to save and invest over the years.
Yeah.
We should have policy that's for the citizens. It should say citizens anticipate that inflation adjusted incomes instead of consumers, right? I mean, I know we're all consumers, but that's a little detached. So good point there, Chris.
Yeah. Once I noticed that, I was like, I'm not a fan of that word anymore. And of course, Nick Gehrli writing here also very recently, September 15th. Folks, this is why no one is buying houses. Income growth is up 21.9% since 2019, so that's 6 years ago. But mortgage costs are up 91.9%. So costs of owning a home, buying a home, just with mortgage, is up 4x faster than incomes. And of course, we have to talk about property taxes and insurance going up faster than incomes as well. What has to happen here? Do incomes go up by 4x? Or do homes come down by about half in price? One of these
Something
two things
has to break. Either incomes are going to have to go up substantially, and housing is going to. I mean, it's either going to balance in the middle, or one's going to meet the other in some manner. So the question is how do they get out of this? Soft landing. They're going to have to navigate this perfectly. If incomes go up dramatically, that's going to crush corporate profits unless they can pass that on. And if housing prices come down, that's a major economic driver within the country. So something has to give and something has to break in some manner.
Yep.
And with AI coming along and what I'm seeing within the job market and inefficiencies, especially on the higher end, it doesn't seem that the job market's going to accelerate to the point right now that there's going to be substantial salary pressure to the upside. It just doesn't appear that way.
Paul, you got to get your terms right. They have a new term for this, brand new term. I didn't know this term, so I just picked this term up yesterday. They're calling it a jobless expansion.
What's that supposed to mean? A jobless expansion.
That's the market's bull case, they say. That's what the market's all excited about.
Inflation's causing top line revenue to go up, but there are no jobs. So, let's just be honest. We're inflating things.
Yeah, it's
jobless expansion,
aka stagflation. It's awful. It's awful. But
yeah,
and again, I don't think the CPI statistics are useful, but they came out and they said, U.S. retail sales increased more than expected as consumers. There we are again. Bought a range of goods and dined out. Blah, 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 all that. They say retail sales rose 0.6% last month after, they were expecting less than that. I'm like, but these aren't inflation adjusted. So please note that retail sales rose 0.6%, but food was up 0.5%, energy was up 0.7%, used cars and trucks are up 1%, and airline fares are up 5.9%. So you could have consumed exactly zero more units of anything and still seen something about 0.6% because you were spending more on all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't have a choice when it comes to food, right? I mean, you got to eat. I mean, yes, there is some adaptation within the budget, but that drives people down to more profitable, less healthy options.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about our jobless expansion, shall we?
Jobless expansion. I'm going to chew on that for 2 or 3 days. I bet I'm thinking about that at 3 o'clock in the morning. How in the world do you come up with that term?
Yeah. So Look, I mean, excuse me, Jerome Powell didn't. I cut it out, but later he said, "Oh, you know, we're expecting this and that for the GDP. They're expecting some slight expansion, but they're still pretty anemic numbers overall, right?" So, our federal government is expanding the debt pile by about 7 or 8% a year at this point. It's like big. I got some numbers on that, but our economy isn't doing that. So this is in the Economist had a nice little chart here. This is 2%. I mean, here we got the U.S. in red. You got Canada just nosediving here for obvious reasons. France way down here. Britain, Italy, Germany, right? So everybody's like at or under 2%. We're barely skimming above zero. And all of these governments are busy borrowing massive amounts of money. And I want to talk about one thing very quickly, which is the United States is doing a little bit better on this particular chart, although that's still super anemic growth. Mm-hmm. And it's doing that, I'll call this a reflexive activity. So because the government is deficit spending by about 7% of GDP, GDP is now higher than it would be. So the more you deficit spend, the higher your GDP is, but the faster your debt goes up. I wish we would strip government deficit spending out of the GDP numbers, because then they'd be more honest.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Second thing is, nobody's trending upwards here. Everybody's sort of kind of slipping this way, you know?
Mm-hmm. And how about we just get a balanced budget with none of this debt expansion and see what it looks like for about a 3 or 4 year period of time, just let the economy work itself out?
Well, then we wouldn't have the inflation. You know, where does inflation come from? It comes from printing money and spending money that hasn't otherwise done anything economically. It's just come out of thin air. Now it's diluting everything, which causes rising prices, which we call inflation. In fact, it's your money getting more worthless. So this caught me, though. So that led down another rabbit hole, that exact thought. I was like, okay, well, let's talk about this, because this just came up. Daniel Horowitz saying it's official. We have approximately a $2 trillion deficit for the first 11 months of this year. So the August numbers just came in. We have one more number in the year because the government runs from September through the end of September. That's its fiscal year. So $1.973 billion deficit so far. And $264 billion of other down at the bottom. I circled in red. Otherwise, it goes to Social Security, Medicare, debt interest, health, national defense, income security. I still don't know what that is. Veterans, benefits and services, education, transportation, and other. I think that other is, I think they're slipping money into data centers projects, but just a guess. Just a guess.
That's a good guess.
And so based on that, so I went into the August numbers, this is just August. This caught me, Paul. I was not ready for this. The August deficit is $345 billion. Wow. Total receipts from every single source, which is individual income taxes, Social Security, customs duties, blah, 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 corporate income taxes. Corporate income tax is only $3 billion. It's like, I don't know what's going on. Total receipts were $344 billion. The deficit was $345 billion, which means that the deficit was, we spent twice as much as we took in the month of August.
Look, let's say an individual comes to you personally to invest, and you know, or asking you to invest to start up a business, and you look at their spending, and they're spending twice what they're taking in. There's no way I would give them funds to go start a business, right? If they can't manage their own resources well, then how could you invest into them? But the government seems to get away with it, and we're okay because asset prices are going up for now.
Yep. So this is, we're on track. This is the third worst deficit in all of history. The other 2 years being, of course, 2020 and 2021, which ostensibly was this COVID emergency, which really wasn't an emergency, but there you have it. And then we had this other idea, Paul, that we were going to, you know, the trade policies were going to lift us out of this. That was a big cornerstone of what Trump and Bessent were up to. And again, Charlie Bilello for the win. Tariffs were pitched as the fix for America's trade deficit. Instead, first 7 months of 2024, we had a $500 billion trade deficit. And first 7 months of 2025, we have a $654 billion trade deficit. So otherwise, in other words, it's a 31% year-over-year increase in trade deficit.
Wow. And that's a lot. That's a 31% increase of money leaving the U.S. and headed into somebody else's pockets.
Yeah, that has to somehow get sopped up and absorbed and round tripped. And, you know, I hope they all like to buy treasuries or something.
Maybe one of the reasons why. Would you reinvest it back into treasuries if you were aware of this data, or would you reinvest it back into resources, commodities, and gold?
I know what I would do. Yeah.
Yeah. Me yeah. too.
I understand the trap the Fed is in because, you know, they just reported that global debt is now over $324 trillion. I want to point out that the United States' debt alone, this is total credit market debt. So that's everything. Corporate, federal, which we talk about all the time, state, municipal, individual. At any rate, we're at $104 trillion. So the U.S. is 32% of all the global debt outstanding. We got it here. So the Fed has a real problem on its hands because it needs this to keep going. It needs us to keep getting deeper and deeper into debt because that's how the system works. And that is what the Fed is there to protect. The Fed is there to, when I say it's there to protect the banking system, what they're really doing is making sure the conditions are favorable so that we can have more loans being made out of the banking system this year than last year. Because otherwise you have a terrifying situation where it goes backwards slightly, even for just a tiny second there, 2009. That almost destroyed the financial system. That was the wiggle that almost destroyed the world. That right there. So they learned their lesson. More debt in the system. Just that's the system. Not saying it's a good thing.
But it's continuing to accelerate. I mean, that's the interesting part. You can see what happened with 2020, but that trajectory is continuing to accelerate. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it's going to be completely unsustainable. And we're probably further away than the average person can imagine and much closer than anybody can anticipate.
I do think so. I think I put in here somewhere, which is, yeah, so this is what we're seeing again from Charlie Bilello. Man, he's really making the rounds. I must have hit his timeline hard. But when we look at, these are different types of outstanding consumer credit. So you got credit cards, you can see they're spiking in delinquencies, kind of near the high that hit back here in the great financial crisis. Student loans had this weird plunge because of the Biden thing, but, you know, clocking back up to 10% delinquent rate. Auto loans creeping back up again, basically at the same height as these other stresses that we had here. Interestingly, mortgages nowhere close to that. Look, mortgage defaults way down here, or delinquencies way down here, nowhere close to that. That was a real estate crisis. This is more of some other credit crisis. And then we have revolving credit down here. Not too bad, but credit cards, student loans, auto loans, higher and higher delinquencies.
Well, I would say if you had some deflation and interest rates got low enough, that mortgage defaults would change. Because of the fact that people have to fight tooth and nail if they've locked in rates lower, because rentals are so much higher, especially if they bought 2019 before. So they're going to do everything that they possibly can to stay in the situation they're in if they can.
All right, Paul, so I think we got a lot of signs out there that, you know, something is happening. We'll have to watch the tea leaves after the Fed rate cuts, what the markets do. They were doing some weird stuff when you and I were talking, and the cuts happened just an hour before we got on here to record this. And so we'll see how the dust settles. But for sure, even before then, we were seeing a lot of crazy stuff like gold. I had to put an exclamation point on it. This caught me. This is Zero Hedge said it's not so secret anymore and posted this chart of Shanghai Futures Exchange gold inventory. So Shanghai just, like, it was like a barely a trading house at all. And then look at this. This is massive, massive explosion in gold inventories. So Shanghai's rapidly, I think that's going to become the gold trading center of the world. London will have lost that for good reason. So will the U.S. eventually.
So there's been rumors over the years that they hold more gold than what they've stated that they hold.
Oh, lots more. Sure, and they do. Yeah.
Obviously, that kind of purchasing would have impact, I would think, would impact gold prices more than it has right now with the rest of the world central banks buying. So why did they decide to disclose all of that now?
I have no idea.
In the back of my mind, I'm wondering if they're closer to rolling out the unit or some type of BRICS currency, or maybe it's just they're trying to bring the gold exchange center there. But that's interesting to me that they reveal this now, because, you know, especially if you're going to hide that in the past, why all of a sudden would that move that far that fast?
Well, this is on the SGE. We still don't know what the People's Bank of China has. They admit to like buying 5 tons, and we know they're buying 10 times that minimum. Well, we suspect strongly, but this is just on their public side. Danny Dion here writing gold and silver are at 1979 overbought level. So here we're looking at a gold chart that goes back to the 70s here. So this is a monthly chart, I guess. So on the monthlies, it has the same overbought. The RSI stochastic is as overbought as it was way back here when it did that little cute little bump. So listen, it's clearly run hard and long. Gold could correct from here for a bit or stabilize for a bit. Wouldn't surprise me. As you and I have talked about, this is the most legendary cup and handle of all times, and it broke out, and that's what happens sometimes when you break out of such an obvious pattern like that. But it's off to the races now. And so when I looked it up, you know, overbought, so the RSI is the relative strength indicator. Is that what it is?
That's correct. Relative strength indicator.
Yeah. So it's a technical, overbought doesn't necessarily mean that there's too many people who've bought stuff relative to supplies. It's measuring the strength of a move by its momentum, its relative strength. And it goes, when it's above 70, it's said to be overbought. And when it's below, what's that, 30, I think it is, they say it's oversold. Okay, fine. What I have found, Paul, is that when you have true market crashes, they actually crash from oversold levels.
Yes. Yes, they do.
And so I think the opposite of that, which I'm less familiar with, is that also true that when you get to really overbought levels, is that where things can really, like, get away from you to the upside? I don't know. But
well, they can. But one of the things that you look at in that chart, going back to the 1979 there, that was kind of the culmination of the end of the, you know, gold popped at that point. But if you go back and look at the numbers, if I remember correctly, the value of gold at that price was around 135% of all dollars in circulation. So the gold, you know, was worth more than the actual dollars in circulation. So that was a way to gauge overvaluation back then. But then you go back and you look, a lot of times those relative strength to the top side is kind of your initiation. So if you go back to before the 2012 top there, you had the first, you know, major overbought since 1979. You corrected for a little bit, then it surged again. But in 2012, when it rolled over, you had a negative divergence where that strength was getting weaker. This overbought is higher than the overbought in the chart back there before it consolidated around 2020 or so. So, you know, that's an indication that there's still demand behind it. Now, I would expect that you get at least a consolidation or pullback, but based on what we've seen since, you know, all this liquidity in the system in the 1990s, there's a high probability that's a buying opportunity before we get higher prices before the run's over.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you look at this right here around the 2007-8 line here, so it was overbought pretty hard on this little peak, but barely pulled back. You know, at the time, it probably felt terrible to me because it went from 600 back to 500 or something. It felt awful. And then it popped again here and then pulled back a little bit. So it went from 1,000 all the way back down to whatever that would have been, about 900. So that would have felt terrible, 10% decline. And then... Yeah. This run from here to here, that took it from 900 all the way up to about just under 2,000. So it can really take a decent run. I mean, that's an almost a doubling in the price there, while it was sort of what you would call an overbought territory most of the time.
And the interesting thing is you had retail that got involved after 2010. I mean, you had a lot of retail involved. And right now you have no retail involved in the gold market. If it is, it's minimal. I mean... Yep. This is institution and central banks, and what's going to happen to the price when retail gets involved, when that retail army shifts from chasing the crypto and the AI trade to moving back into the metals if the Fed is making a policy mistake.
Right. Well, just to put all that in perspective, Honza Cerny said it in just 1 month, which would have been the July figure, the U.S. public debt jumped by $550 billion to $37.3 trillion. By the way, that's equivalent to, if you went out on the open market, you could have bought 13.9 billion with a B ounces of silver instead with your same 550 billion, which, by the way, is 15 years of silver mining, just off the top of my head. 1 month. 1 month of extra money creation. You could have bought 15 years of silver output. Crazy.
Wow. That's really good information there.
I got a few other charts here, but you know, we just had the summit. It was great up there on the lake in New Hampshire. And you gave a couple talks up there. And the thing I thought people were really keying on is they wanted to know about, like, given all this stuff we're talking about, like, how do you go about tell your strategy? Like, you have a risk managed portfolio. That's the prime strategy. But under that, there's a lot of moving parts. Like I know people ask you some questions about that because I think people want to know.
Like, yes.
How do you actually go about operating in this kind of an environment? Because it looks a little crazy to me.
Very carefully. So it's a if then, then that. And I've got a graph here that I can show. I think it has the correct disclosures that kind of shows the flow of how you make adaptations in the portfolio. But there are a couple of things that you have to pay attention to. Right. It's impossible to pick a market top. It's impossible to pick a market bottom. There are people that are day traders that have a chance to do it, but that has its own issues associated with it. So you have to recognize, number one, what are the valuations of the market? Just to get back to a reversion to the mean, how much downside risk is there? And that tells you the risk that's associated in the portfolio. Volatility is our friend as long as the trend is with us, the money flow is there. You know, there's periods of time where, like, gold's overbought right now. You might start averaging in. There's other times that gold's oversold where if you don't have any, you can buy it outright and embrace that volatility. And then you look for, you know, momentum indicators to indicate that, hey, this is ending. You get some consolidation. You get a blow off top. You know, you can start reducing some positions there. But the biggest thing for the U.S. and, you know, U.S. investor right now is we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. So how in the world do you make adaptations? And I'm waiting on my presentation chart to pull up here. So how do you make those adaptations? Well, at least there's a way to attempt to make those adaptations versus your modern portfolio theory. So this was kind of wild to the individuals that were out there. It was a good question. Somebody came up and said, hey, when will some of your big institutions and modern portfolio theory or pensions start increasing their allocation to a lot of sectors? And I've asked a lot of questions over the past 5 years of institutions and connections I have, and it's really based on past performance and strength. So they have to have a 3 to 5 year look back before they're going to increase allocation in a certain sector. Well, if you've got a 3 to 5 year look back before you're making that adaptation, yeah, that's good because you're participating in the trend long term. But what happens if you stay in the AI trade for way too long and it's down 50% before you get that 3 to 5 year look back? So how do we as individual investors make adaptations? So, you know, I'll take you through just kind of the basic side. This is just the major market indexes. On the right, we've got 2008 till 2025. Right. The only game in town really since 2013, 2014 has been domestic equities. Okay. That's great if you're in modern portfolio theory as a U.S. investor because you're going to be overweight U.S. equities pretty much at all time. Now, if you have some forced diversification, which they should, but I haven't seen any modern portfolio theory allocations that have any commodities exposure into them right now because the problem is they're chasing that performance. Right. So everybody's benchmark is the S&P 500 because Vanguard, Fidelity, all these companies have done such a good job of marketing that product that they have to offer, which is ridiculously profitable for them, which turns into passive investing. But from 2008 to 2025, U.S. equities, S&P 500 is up about 328%. This was as of July 18th, I think. Mm-hmm. So international equities, developed market, Europe, Canada, Australia, 17% total since January 1st, 2008. Commodities are in the index, Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, is still down 9.5%. And emerging markets are up 0.4%. Well, I don't have it on this chart. I've shown it before. But we saw the same outperformance in U.S. equities in the 1990s, really after the Japanese bubble burst in the late 1980s. And the internet bubble, technology bubble 1.0, looked very similar to this. But from 2000 to 2007, after that euphoria wore off and we went back to a more reversion to the mean economy, S&P 500 did nothing for 7 years. Okay. I mean, we didn't have absolute calamity back then. It just priced in too much growth. S&P did nothing. But as the money started coming out of that bubble, it started looking for areas that looked attractive. Commodities were underpriced. Emerging markets were underpriced. Now, granted, they had the same volatility of about a 47% decline as the S&P 500. But from 2000 to 2007 year end, you know, commodities were up 213%, emerging markets up 155%, international up 28%, and domestic equities just flat. So how do you adapt to that? Now, what we'll do is start with a view from 30,000 feet. So this is not going to animate like it should. But you can only invest into all of your dollars go into one of six categories. It's either domestic equities, whether that's real estate or equities, international equities, commodities, money market, currency, or fixed income. Now, I have never seen a modern portfolio theory allocation that will use currencies. Now, currencies, for, you know, if we get into a dollar crisis or something that's very important to use as a tool, especially if you've got a market that's going down and a currency that's going down. So that's not something we're going to use very often, but it's a tool on the shelf that we can pull out and plug in if we need to.
Well, it's interesting because I know sometimes people put gold into a commodity basket, but I don't. I put it in the currency basket. It's money. It's kind of an anti-dollar. It has a currency-like component. That's part of what gold is, I think.
That's correct. Now, I classify it in, I look at it on both sides, but I classify it as a commodity for, you know, just because that's a classification purpose.
Yep.
But here's what we do. So Tom Dorsey, he retired several years ago with Dorsey Wright and Associates, their research group, kind of developed this after he was coming through the 70s and the 80s. So it's just relative strength. It's comparing each of these, and let's just make it simple. It's money flow. So we can see if all the money's running into U.S. equities, which we've seen international investors are overweight U.S. equities. Retirees are more overweight U.S. equities than they've been at any time in the past, and this is just chasing performance. But if that's rank number one, you need to be overweight domestic equities. And then you need some forced diversification because we don't want to be all in one place. So international equities is the next. And then you can narrow that down to whatever top three or five countries are there. And then in yellow is kind of like question mark. Like these are too clear that we need to own based on the analysis. And this isn't necessarily where we are right now. This is just stepping you through how the flow works. So you look at commodities. Well, gold since 2016, if you classify it as a commodity, has been really the only commodity that said, hey, put us in the portfolio. And it's done really good in performance over that period of time, but it tells you to avoid everything else. In that environment, you only hold enough money market for emergency savings, no currencies in the portfolio. And unless you're, you know, it's appropriate to have fixed income in the portfolio, you avoid fixed income. Now, how do you make adaptation? So what if we go from an environment we've been in to that 2000 to 2007? So this doesn't flow as good, but another example rating is if we're in a period of time like 2000 to 2007 and commodities is the number one ranked category, then the base parameters of our strategy allow us to go up to 30% commodities. Now that's in one sector. So we could be 40 or 50% commodities if the money flow is strong enough. And if commodities are leading, typically you're going to have Latin America, your commodity producing countries that are going to be very profitable and doing good. And you have those as a large part of the portfolio. And now you might be from 85% U.S. equities, 80, 85% to where you might have 5, 10, 15% domestic equities. And then as that money starts leaving those categories at other times, this pops them all back in here. And I wish this one would flow up just on its own. If you're in a period of time like 2000 to 2003, where you've got this recession, but you've got that bubble deflating in the NASDAQ that went down 80%, U.S. equities, S&P went down about 47, then it tells you, hey, you might be a 100% equity investor, but you need to be focused on fixed income during this period of time because it's holding up better than other asset classes or parked in money market. And then when that information changes and the leadership changes, then you start deploying capital in some of those other areas. So that's an oversimplification about how we deal with it. But from my standpoint, what's so beneficial about having this ranking is I can be concerned about what's taking place in the future. I can pay attention to it and I can anticipate it. But until that money flow starts changing and that ranking starts changing, then we may play the game exactly as it is. But this is what gives us an indication to either head towards cash and money market, because that money flow is starting to show some weakness, or redeploy that capital. You know, let's say the dollar cracks, the Fed makes a mistake, the dollar cracks, commodities take off, international equities take off relative to US. It allows me to confidently make moves in that direction and then tell clients, yeah, this is going to be volatile. I know it's going to be scary because US markets are coming apart, but we got to embrace volatility because the money flow is telling us to be in these sectors. And it helps you to adapt regardless of what's thrown at us in the future. And that adaptation is important. Now, if you've got some diverse, if you're not 100% invested in the S&P 500 and the S&P 500 is the only game in town and you've got 15% that's in international that's not keeping up, you're going to underperform the S&P. That's a weakness of having an adaptive strategy. But what happens if we have a 2000 to 2007 and that outperformance of commodities and emerging markets and international lasted until 2012, actually, 2013. So that's a 12, 13-year period of time that if you have some adaptation in your portfolio where you can tweak based on money flow, because big institutions are going to take the opportunity and that euphoria to offload their assets on you. And that's one of the things that concerns me about where we are in the market right now. I know the markets look good, but it's really just your top 10 stocks that are carrying these overall indexes. The breadth of the market, which means how many stocks are participating in all of these gains, is ridiculously weak right now and is an indication of late cycle economic environment. But it's masked because these indexes are cap weighted. So if you've got your top 7 or 10 stocks that are garnering all of the assets and get the performance because of the story around AI, what is it? The top 10 represent 38 to 42% of the S&P 500. So that means that because they've garnered all these assets, every passive dollar that you put into the S&P 500 is somewhere between 38 to 42% and 10 stocks. And you know, now look, I'm not a big believer of spreading funds across 700 investments, but the reality is most people, the average person just doesn't realize that's what's taking place. And this euphoria has meant value stocks, Buffett, you know, I don't know what the data is today, had underperformed the S&P 500 in Berkshire Hathaway by the greatest margin of any year in the past outside of late 1999. So, you know, we've got all these markers that are in there that are telling us that things are starting to change. Commodities are higher on our ranking list right now than what they have in the past, which is why we're not fully allocated to commodities, but we've got enough in there to match what the money flow is showing us right now. And we'll ramp that up if that continues, or if, you know, if that, you know, falls and goes the other way, then we'll dial that back down. And then there's other indicators that I don't have on that presentation right now that can say, lights out, you've had a decision point. The highest probability is that, you know, the markets are going down from here. And when that main indicator goes off, you know, it's historically been around 80% correct. Now, it doesn't tell you whether the market's going to go down 50% or 5% or 10% or 15%. But when that main indicator, which is a momentum oscillator developed by Carl Swinlan with a Decision Point was the name of his company, which I love it because his argument is when the information says that the path of least resistance is down, or maybe you've got 5 to 10% upside, but 20 to 50% downside, and you cross that line, you have a decision to make. Do you think it's different this time? Because you're afraid of missing out here in the short run, or as an advisor, you're afraid of, you know, being too cautious for a 6-month period? Or do you heed that warning and pay attention to that decision point and lower your risk, batten down the hatches, and put yourself in a position to buy when everybody else is panicking?
Well, one other thing that's a little bit different this time is that we have a lot of speculation going on. I couldn't help it. Margin debt just surged to an all-time new record or high. We talk about this almost every week, so it's kind of like gold surging to new records. But So with all of those risk things, I was just wondering, like, how, you know, it feels risky because so right here is where 1999, Warren Buffett's badly underperforming the S&P because he's in cash. And then wouldn't you know it, we had this little stock market correction and things went this way and margin debt went down because it's really a lot of fun on the way up. And that's where it burst. But that was our first experience with it there from about 1990 up through about 1999. And it surged up and then people got clocked and cleaned out. And that's, of course, this is where Warren Buffett did fantastic. Same thing coming up to the great financial crisis. And then this whole period, this was just, people don't recognize this, Paul, but this was massive money printing by the Fed rescues over and over again, 2011, 13, 15, 17. I kept seeing signs that the wheels were about to come off. And once you know it, September 2019, the wheels actually came off. The overnight repo market's blowing up, creaking, popping sounds everywhere. And, oh, wouldn't you know it, you know, COVID. So the Fed really printed, gave us this little ginormous thing. This was 2022. Remember 2022? Stocks and bonds both had terrible. That was the worst paired return because there was nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
If you're in stocks or bonds, it didn't work out. And so that came back. But then, we're back off to the races. No lessons learned. So I think that this speaks to me and says, you know, you got to have a nimble strategy because there's rocket fuel in this market. It, easy come, easy go, up, down, gyration. But look at that, $1 trillion of borrowing to bet on stocks, to speculate.
And that really kind of bottomed around 23, 24. Like when David Russell showed that chart at the summit, and you showed that, I literally had to pick my chin up off the floor because I glanced at it, but I've not looked at it in 7 or 8 months. Because it's not a main indicator, but oh my gosh, that just indicates where we are. Now, let me go back and talk about 2022, which was pretty interesting from our strategy standpoint. We had all kinds of warnings in late 21 on the U.S. equity indexes. Now, energy and a couple of things that were in the portfolio actually, you know, stayed in there, surprisingly. But typically, you know, 2008, we batten down the hatches, we get this massive sell signals. The 20-year treasury is something that's great to deploy in the portfolio, especially if interest rates are going down. So I literally was kind of sitting there a little grin, and I'm like, okay, I don't know how far the market's going to go down, but it looks like, you know, 10 to 20% on the downside. I started looking at the 20-year, and then I look at my indicators. My indicators go, no. So we sit in money market, treasury money market. And then a month later, you know, I'm looking at it every day. It's like, you know, just give me the buy signal. Give me the buy signal. Give me the buy signal. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's like, no, 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 no. And I had to do a little bit of hand-holding with some of my more aggressive clients. They're like, man, can you not deploy it anywhere? Especially the ones that remember, you know, how TLT and some of the others did during those sell-offs. And I'm like, no. Like, I don't want to front-run our tools because they're telling me no. When I cross the decision point to purchase, we'll allocate. But in hindsight, when that year was over, you were far better off to sit in treasury money market because if you just sat there, I think the 2022 return was somewhere around 4.25% in treasury, where TLT, some of these others were down 20% for the year. And it was brutal on a lot of portfolios. And then, of course, you know, November 2022, we started getting some green lights on the market, and I, you know, go off and puke off the back porch because, you know, it did not feel like a good time to buy, but the indicators were saying you need to ramp up your risk a little bit.
Yep.
So, you know, that for me in these environments, you know, the strength of the tools that we utilize is they give you every chance that you possibly can to miss these major market downturns. So that's the strength. The weakness is there's periods of time where it's going to cause you to be more cautious when valuations are high, breadth is not good, institutional money flow seems to be selling equities to retail, but it helps you to walk that path less traveled. So, you know, you might miss a little bit of opportunity in these euphoric years, but missed opportunity is typically not what wipes somebody out. Now, if you're 30 years old, hey, you know, embrace that volatility, just keep dollar cost averaging in because you have that. But if you're at or close to retirement and you're in that distribution phase, those downturns mean the difference between a potentially miserable retirement where the dreams that you had do not come to fruition and the nightmares that you were worried about become closer to reality. So it's the long game that we're looking at and making those adaptations. And the thing is, at some point, the U.S. markets are not going to be the only game in town. And that's going to be the opportunity for those that are adaptive to really make up for feeling a little bit left behind in the interim period. So
well, you have to play the game, though.
People.
Like you said, you have to listen. I don't like how the game is set up, but it's the game, right? So I would prefer, Paul, that I could just work, save some money, and have a predictable future. So I could save up enough and go, well, because I know how much food is going to cost in the future and electricity and insurance and real estate taxes, I could sort of get a nest egg aside and run it out. But you don't know. You know, who knew that real estate taxes were going to go up 7% last year on average, right?
Right.
That's probably not part of any typical financial plan where people are like, what do you think your real estate taxes are going to be? They, you know?
Chris, when we do the planning, I mean, the minimum inflation estimation that I'll use is 3.5%.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of popular in the industry now. People looked at you 10 years ago like you were crazy to be running 3.5% inflation estimates. Oh, it'll never be more than 2%. That's the Fed mandate. Well, yeah, I'm glad I didn't believe the Fed mandate. But then you stress tested against 5.5%. I'm glad that we've done that historically because it's let people know, you know, I mean, it's amazing what the planning tool does. Like, and the reason I take people through that is I'm like, okay, look, let's say your budget's $80,000 a year. That's what you want to retire on. It really doesn't matter what it is because it's relative to every individual. And that's the one thing that our industry's done a terrible job of telling people that is the most important thing. And I'll show them. I'll say, okay, it's $80,000. What about repairing the house? How often do you replace your cars? You know, are you going to do it out of your income budget or is it going to come out of your portfolio? So we talk through that. We build all that stuff in there. And then I run it at 3.5. And then I run it at 5.5, and the outcome is dramatic. And then we'll say, okay, well, instead of $80,000 a year, what if you've underestimated your budget and you actually spend $90,000 a year? And somebody may go from a 90% probability of success to 50. I mean, most people don't realize when you're in that distribution phase in retirement, there's a point. Barry had a good idea. I need to put my quotes up here, but I'd have to put 500 quotes up there to get them all. So was it Mark Twain that said you go bankrupt slowly and then all at once?
I think that was Hemingway.
Hemingway said you go bankrupt slowly and then all at once.
Slowly, then all at once. Yeah.
So I want to point out to people that if you think you can live on 80, but you're actually spending 90, that extra $10,000 a year can blow your entire retirement margin to pieces. And then at that point, it's like, well, you know, you hope that you live to 87, but then you're like, kind of, I hope I don't live that long because I'm going to run out of money, you know, before I get there. So there's two components of what we do, the planning and the income. You know, as I tell clients, once we get that budget together, we've got inflation adjustment in there. Most people don't take pay raises for about every three to four years, depending. Some people take it every year. They want to spend that budget. But my argument is, as long as you don't draw more than after tax than what we budgeted in the portfolio, go have a great time. You know, we're running a risk managed strategy. It's designed to help protect against those major declines that can wipe you out. And it gives them the peace of mind. And it also, you know, keeps them on a budget. And then on our side, it's not about beating some arbitrary index, right? If you're 80 years old, you don't need to be beating the S&P 500 because you're carrying far more risk than what you need to. Even if you're 70, you don't necessarily need to be beating the S&P. That shouldn't be your objective. You need to manage those funds in a manner to where they can provide the income that you need in retirement, fight off inflation, and at a minimum level of success, make sure the only check that bounces is to the funeral home. Right? You don't have to worry about your kids taking care of you. That's a funny story. I used to run ads years ago that the minimum level of retirement success is the only check that bounces to the funeral home. So I had every funeral home within from Atlanta to Chattanooga calling me like, I don't like that ad. But that's the reality. We want to take whatever we have and leave the corpus, the principal, to our kids, you know, or charity of our choice, or we hope that it's going to continue to grow all the way through retirement. But when you look at those different starting years and you do actual historical periods, there's a wide range of outcomes. So you can't overestimate. You cannot assume, like Wall Street wants you to, that that the next 35, 40 years is going to be like the past 35 to 40 years, because this is an anomaly from the growth that we've seen throughout history. And we're starting to understand that it was false growth because globalization and jobs being shipped overseas and the gutting of our employment base, manufacturing within our country, masks the money printing that our government, the governments around the world are doing. So if we get more of the same, inflation is going to be our greatest risk going forward, which is completely opposite of asset price inflation, but asset price inflation because of that money printing. It's going to go into our, you know, our cost of living may go up just as fast as what the market did in the past 30 years. And you have to be able to navigate that, because you can't choose, you can't go back and say, hey, I'd like to have a time capsule and go back and retire in 1975. If I could, that's when I'd go retire. That's the single best forward, you know, starting point throughout history. But we can't do that. You know, we were born at a date. We hit retirement at a certain date. You can work a little bit longer, and as long as your health allows you, but you have to be prepared. My job is to help people get through that with a strategy that can help them stay the course, because I can tell you, I've been doing this for 27 years. It's easy to make money. It's hard to keep it. It's easy to make money in a bubble when the wind's at your sails. You feel overly smart. You think that you can anticipate what's going on. But if you've not invested through a, you know, in the distribution phase through 2000, 2003, or 2008, it's just some arbitrary story that you're being told. And I can tell you, I saw the most hardy investors that while they were working and they still had a job, could handle volatility. It didn't bother them. They, you know, they were still dollar cost averaging in. But once you retire, you've been retired for a couple of years, you don't want to go back to that rat race. You don't want to have to deal. You're enjoying getting to see your grandkids, your hobbies, volunteering within the community. And you take a 40, 50% decline, you know, do you cut your income and cut your lifestyle in half? Or do you just hope that it's going to work out? Or do you implement a strategy that can, you know, not going to put you on the cover of the Wall Street Magazine necessarily, but it's also not going to put you on the foreclosure ads within the ads in the paper either. You know, you're walking that path that's resilient over time that can help you navigate whatever's coming, because we're going to have to be adaptable in the future. I mean, we're just going to have to, because the trend that we're on is completely unsustainable. And the good thing is there's ridiculous opportunities in so many other areas, because everybody's chasing, you know, this perceived performance and new age economy that we're in. And, you know, I cannot tell you how many times I hear people say, well, the government won't allow that to happen. Okay. That's you're assuming the government can act like God and control all things. And there are so many forces in a complex system that they can't control. And it seems that they only have one tool. Let's print more and let's cut rates more. But what we're seeing is the impact becomes shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And at some point, the more of the same is going to kill the patient. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but the doctors out there can say, you know, there are some medications in right doses that can help someone. But if you just keep doing more and more and more, and I'm one of those that's learned in the past, you know, hey, if we can do this, I'll do twice as much and it might work. That doesn't work all the time.
Indeed. Well, thank you for that. And I'm sure for anybody who's interested in working with Paul and his team, you're wondering, how do you do that? And it's very simple. You go to this website, peakfinancialinvesting.com, and there's Paul. And if you click on one of these Find an Advisor buttons here, you'll come to a very simple form that you fill out. Anything that's in red is required. And just tell a little about yourself. People type some amazing stories into these boxes sometimes. Just click away and you submit. And when you hit the submit button, you know what's going to happen? An email gets sent out to Paul's team. They look at that. If you've got your correct contact info in there, they will get a hold of you within 48 business hours and set up a meeting so you can take it from there.
And it's an honor for everybody that's reached out. And what I want to encourage people is we run the planning process for people in that meeting. You know, you can have an introductory call, or you can jump straight to the introductory call where you ask us any questions and we go on that planning process. But even if, you know, there's people that have reached out to us that it may be a year or two before before there's any of their assets that are available for us to be able to manage. But now we have that basis in place so that they have a plan. They know where they are. We've made that contact so that if the time comes and they need to move fast, that we can move fast because we've already established that relationship and they know where they are. So, I mean, our mission is we serve people, not money. If we can help you manage your resources prudently and navigate the days ahead, everything else will take care of itself. But, you know, we're not salesy. You know, our only objective is to help those that we serve be successful. And I pray every day that God will grant us wisdom that we can pass on to somebody else so that they can, you know, make wise and prudent decisions for themselves, their family, our communities, and our country.
Excellent. If you've been following our program, you know that we're going to hope for the best, but we're going to have to prepare as if these markets are going to do what they've always done when they got a little bit stretched and a little bit silly. And that's correct. So a risk managed approach is the thing I endorse most heartily in this environment, not a passive approach. So with that, Paul, thanks for your time today. So good to see you up at the summit. We'll do it again next year.
Oh, that summit is great. For those of you that missed it, I got to tell you, it's wonderful. It is the best event that I've been to, from quality conversation, people, discussion. You know, if you want to go next year, because it's a great time. It is. And great content. All of your speakers were incredible.
Yeah. It's real, really thoughtful. I came home thinking about a lot of things I hadn't quite thought about before. So that's why I love it. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you next week. Bye for now.